tape 11872. This is the initial contact interview tape recording with Jesse Haber Butler. She was actively involved as a lobbyist for the National Consumers Union, and very early, around the time of the passage of the suffrage amendment, became a lobbyist for the League of Women Voters. She had traveled with Mrs. Kant from state to state on the tour, which was attempting to rally support for the ratification of the suffrage amendment. Up until this time, she had not been active in the suffrage movement, though she knew many of the people, including Alice Paul, and spent time in the tea house at the National Women's Party house. During the 1920s, she was in England. This interview was an attempt to get a broad picture of her life for later, more detailed interviews, particularly in the period from 1909 and her graduation from Smith till 1920, when she left the United States for England. The interview was conducted first in her bed sitting room in the Hillcrest retirement community, and the latter part of the interview took place in the sitting room of the building. As is obvious, Mrs. Butler is quite lucid and has no memory gaps. The interview begins with her describing her secretarial training during the summer away from Smith College. Earlier background material, including stories about her mother and her feminist consciousness, were off tape and will be recovered later.
Went back to Colorado, and an Englishman there on a ranch, who was a graduate of Oxford University, tipped me off to learn shorthand typewriting. And at that time, it was not considered very classy for a Smith graduate to learn shorthand typewriting. You know, they were all teachers. And he said my father was a clever businessman, and he thought I was like him. And are you taking this down now? Oh. Well, anyway, he thought that I was a good deal like my father, and that the day is coming when businessmen were going to want college women in their offices. So, between junior and senior year, when I got home, my family thought, since I was living luxuriously in Smith, I should now be the weekly lady cleaning in the house. But I didn't like housework very well, so at once I decided to learn shorthand typewriting instead. And I went to this business college in Pueblo all summer. And the minute I hit that typewriter, I found I couldn't spell. And there were a lot of other things I didn't know that I thought I knew, and so I worked very hard. And then I worked in my father's office for 2 years and took in legal secretarial work to earn some extra money in the building where my father had his real estate office. And at the end of 2 years, I went back to Reunion at Smith. And there I found that the English teacher had opened up an office to get jobs for Smith graduates that weren't teachers. So I hip-footed hot and heavy to her office, and she said, well, Jesse, what can you do? And I said, I'm a legal secretary. And she said, I have 100 jobs here for you right now. You are the first Smith woman to enter my office trained for a business career. So I said, well, where are the jobs? And one of them was with the Macmillan Publishing Company on Fifth Avenue as assistant to the head of the college textbook department. By September of that year, 1911, I started my work on Fifth Avenue with a secretary and file clerk. I never touched a typewriter. But he wouldn't have anyone there who didn't know how to typewrite, because that was considered a business training. And my salary was $14 a week. Cut it off a minute. That I couldn't live on $14 a week in New York City. I asked my superior when I was going to get a raise, and he said Christmas time. And in Christmas time, there was a raise, $1 bill. And I took it in and waved it at him and said, is this the raise? And he said, yes. But I was very mistaken to take exception to this because Jesse Reed was in that company, a Wellesley graduate, had been there 25 years, had edited whole series of books, and she was now getting $25 a week. And I sure didn't compete with her. What I did to get Jesse Reed a $6,000 salary and then got myself ready to be moved out as a result of my efforts, I walked up Fifth Avenue where the five women's colleges had started an employment service for college women who were Knox teachers. And they said, oh goody, we knew this was going on there at that company. And we're tickled to death to see you, and we have another gorgeous job for you. And the job was to be secretary, the first secretary of the Pulitzer School of Journalism at Columbia. And instead of $14 a week, I was to get $85 a month. And I was to be allowed to live in Whittier Hall, the lovely Columbia dormitory. Quite a change from the horrible cheap boarding house that I was inhabiting near the McMillan Company. I stayed there for 2 years. And then again, there was a very bad situation for employment situation from the feminist point of view that I couldn't take. I didn't know I was a feminist in those days, but I knew what was endurable, and I didn't intend to die on the job. So I went again to my employment office on Fifth Avenue, and they had a job in Boston to be a statistician and investigator for the Massachusetts Minimum Wage Commission. And on this job, I was to get $1,300 a year. So Amy Hughes, who ran that work, she was a professor at Holyoke, interviewed me. I got the job, and I landed in Boston.
Now that was about 1915?
That was about 1913. And there I stayed 4 years and was taught statistics and investigation skills, working to bring about a minimum wage commission for women in the state of Massachusetts, because this was the era when women were beginning to work outside their homes, but they were the most exploited workers that ever existed. They were getting $4 a week in candy factories, in laundries, and in a Woolworth store. So, but they got a law through the state legislature up there, the Consumers League was at the bottom of that, and they got a law through the state legislature that their employees were to be allowed to copy their payrolls. So I was sent out to these big factories and industries to copy payrolls, and then taught how to take those facts back and put them into tables, statistical tables. It was a very great educational and training era for me, and I wanted more than anything else to help women. I seem to have a, where that desire came from, I'll have to tell you later, that's a big story. And so I stayed there 4 years. And then the World War I started. When did World War I started? I've forgotten the date. And the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics started a cost of living investigation in Washington, D.C. And I applied for a job there and immediately moved to Washington and became one of the investigators for the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics.
And that must have been about 1917 then?
No.
Or it was after the U.S. entered the war?
Yeah.
So it would be 1918.
Mm-hmm. And then I got interested in the Consumers League of Washington, D.C., and they wanted to get a minimum wage law for Washington, D.C., as an example for the rest of the United States, as the United States Congress governed Washington. So I was employed then as the secretary of the Washington Consumers League. And then Justice Brandeis wrote the bill that had to go through the Congress to give the minimum wage to women in Washington, and I was appointed the lobbyist to get that bill through. And he thought, Justice Brandeis thought it would take us 2 years to get it through, and I got it through in 6 months, to the astonishment of everybody. And that's how I got mixed up with the women's suffrage, the final days of the women's suffrage. Not the secretaries, and when they heard our heels, don't move. It was the Packers hearing that's described there.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's a very interesting story because I was really at the head of the procession of women working outside their homes and into industry. I was running into all the problems headlong, and being a pioneer stock from Colorado, I was a pioneer up there, you see. It was great. I never had so much fun.
Then you remained a lobbyist for the Consumers League beyond the passage of the bill?
Oh, yes. I got the bill through. And then this tremendous legislation on the meat packers industry, and my father being a cattleman, I knew the whole story from the ground up. And I began working on that, and I got the Consumers League to work on it, and it was from that that Mrs. Catt took me with her on the last trip around the West to get the ratification of the Woman Suffrage Amendment. I went with her, not as a suffragette, but as someone who would talk about the kind of legislation that women should be interested in once they got the vote. She was terrified because the meat packers followed me the whole place around. There was this group of them in every gallery where I spoke, waiting for me to slip up so they could clap a legal restrainer on me for my talk, but I only used material that had come out at the hearing in Washington, so nobody, it was all public material. And as a result, though, of the rumpus I kicked up, President Woodrow Wilson
was that the Federal Trade Commission?
Yeah. Founded the Federal Trade Commission.
Now,
he didn't know, nobody knew who'd kicked up this row.
Were you involved with the suffragists prior to the trip with Mrs. Catt?
Well, you know, I was intimately involved with them. For instance, Alice Paul had a lovely house there right across from the White House where everybody ate. And I was with them, but I did not work for them because I had all I could do what I was doing.
So you weren't involved with them in the picketing towards the final?
But they were all my intimate friends. And Mrs. The leading picket woman, I'll get her name now, was one of the first women that was in my first class in public speaking when I came back to Washington after being in London 8 years. She helped me start my public speaking work, that woman did, and she was one of those. There was Mrs. Kent, the wife of the Kent that gave me the money to take the trip. She was, they all went into prison, you know, and fasted, didn't eat anything, and had food pushed down their stomachs and all that. It was terrible stories.
Yes.
So I was very close to all that, but I wasn't, they worked hard to get me involved, but I couldn't earn a living and get involved. They all had husbands, so they ate. I got inclined to go in for... as rugged program as they followed, because I like Mrs. Kent's system better, but they'd have never got one of suffrage if they had depended just on Mrs. Kent. It was the day after they burned Woodrow Wilson in effigy that he decided to go up to the Capitol and ask for woman suffrage. And it was the first time a president had ever gone to the Senate and asked for legislation. He started that.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband and I sat in the gallery the day he did it. So, and he gave Mrs. Kent the credit for everything. But it was Alice Paul's efforts that caused him to do it. All right. He didn't like being burned in an effigy out in front of the White House. Now, the check comes in about when World War I was ending. And then that's when I worked for the minimum wage.
Well, let's see, we did that, yes.
We had the trip. We got that when I was, as I started being a lobbyist.
Okay, can you just briefly tell me about it, and then we'll go back into that.
Becoming a living.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's see, my danger is I go into such details, you see. And then the trip with Mrs. Kent, and then marriage, and then England.
Right.
Is that what you want?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I started in by saying there was the, what was the first one I mentioned? There was the communal living. Oh, yes. And then there was the lobbying at the Capitol for the National Consumers League on the minimum wage for women and on the... meat packers hearing, and the hearings on the meat packing industry, and then from that I was led to Mrs. Tapp and got $500 to pay my way to go with her as she went through the far west getting every state to ratify the woman suffrage amendment. And we spoke in every state. From the when we got to the Sacramento, the suffragists there got us into the room of the United States of the State Senate, and we did our speaking from the platform of the State Senate in Sacramento. And then we came down to Los Angeles and spoke there, and I spoke on the same platform with Mrs. Kent at all these places. On the meatpacking industry as an example of the issues that the new voters would have to cope with. And that's why we needed woman suffrage. Stop it a minute. No, okay. At the end of that trip, Mrs. Kent had her final meeting of the National American Woman Suffrage Association, in which she wound up its business. And at that meeting, the National League of Women Voters was created. And she invited me to come to St. Louis, where that meeting was held, and sit on the platform when the League of Women Voters was created. And at the end of that meeting, I was appointed the first lobbyist, or they called it legislative advocate, for the National League of Women Voters. Then I went back to Washington to the Muncie Building where they had their office and worked with them all summer, getting their legislative program in order for the United States Congress. And at that summer, my four-year relation with my husband, future husband, matured into a suggestion that I go with him to London when he was appointed Trade Commissioner for the United States Department of Commerce. It was one of the most difficult decisions I ever made in my life, to leave the best Washington job I'd ever had, or anybody'd ever had, and give it up and get married, which I never wanted to do. And there's a long story in there that I can't tell here of the pressure that was on me not to get married, because his mother was determined that he should never marry. And we had 4 months of terrible pulling and hauling. I was trying to get out of marrying him because the situation was so difficult, but meanwhile I'd had gotten so used to him, I found to my horror I couldn't get along without him. You know what I mean.
Did you, when you say that you had decided you weren't going to get married before, did you agree with Hazel Hunkins and the other women who didn't believe in marriage?
No, I didn't advertise the fact of what I thought about it. I just wasn't going to get married, but I wasn't going to have babies either, unless I had a very respectable matrimony. I was that conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And then, after a fierce and unbelievable struggle, the situation, the deck cleared, and I went to Colorado and visited my family. And in December 6, 1920, we were married in New York City in the little office of John Haynes Home, the great preacher for the
Unitarian organization.
We were married by him with his little clerk as evidence, because the opposition of my husband's family to the marriage made him unwilling to have anything but a very simple marriage, you see. This was rectified later in London when I had a chance to be presented at the Court of St. James, and I pointed out that since I hadn't had an elaborate marriage, I would like to go to court to make up for it. And by that time, I guess he felt I had earned the right to go to the court. And that's another story. So that on August 12th, we saw ourselves taking the good ship Aquitania, the Christmas ship Aquitania, for London. Terrified at the idea of leaving America.
And that would also mean an end to your own career.
Complete end to my career. And this was, the decision was made on a deep spiritual basis that I can't go into here. The most difficult and important decision of my life that changed my life and improved it and gave me, my husband gave me a great experience that broadened my whole career, my life and everything. Invaluable. Marriage is that way. Amen. Well, then we got to London just a short time before Christmas. I'll cut it off a minute. Now, before you open it, the Garden Suburb, the first planned community in any English-speaking country. You see, all these planned communities out here are copies of that. We bought a house in the Hampstead Garden suburb, the only Americans ever to buy a house. They all rented, see. And we bought this house, and my husband's father died. He sent us $4,500, and I bought all antique furniture for 11 rooms at sales. So I became an authority on antique furniture. I got a brilliant English woman to help me and guide me in everything I bought, and paid her a small percentage, and that's the next activity. I had. For you see, first this bed, then in this house with all this antique furniture, and going to all these child clinics, mother's clinics they were called, learning how to have a baby, and then I had a baby. My daughter was born. I was then 38 years old, and I breastfed her 9 months. And that to me was the most exciting thing I ever did, to learn to breastfeed my baby. All the English babies are breastfed. And Queen Mary brought Sir Truby King from, not New Zealand, but the other place, the what's the other little island down there, Australia?
Oh, Tasmania?
That, no. That other island that's so famous.
Borneo?
No, it's right next to Australia. He had made a science of breastfeeding, and Queen Mary brought him to London, and they established breastfeeding centers all over London. And then I spent months and months studying breastfeeding and how to do it, and I did it for 9 months, and I was 38 years old.
What was the year then?
That was, she was born in 1924. And then my son was born in 1940, and I breastfed him. And then I established my English home. I had a governess and a cook. And then I organized at the American Woman's Club a current events club. I discovered that in the American Woman's Club, which is now very big and beautiful, in a beautiful building, they bought a great, big, beautiful house on Grosvenor Square. And I discovered in that club that there were women from all over the world. So I started the current events club there, and I had them all come in and give current events reports from all over the world where they lived. And that was my day off. The doctor in Germany had said, now when a woman like you has a family, you must have one day off in 7. And I said, why, doctor, how can I do that? And I thought, I could never do that anymore. And he said, how could I have one day off in 7? And he said, that's why you had a college education, to think that one up. So on my one day off in 7, I went out to the club and ran the most brilliant current events circle you ever saw in all your life. And these women were from Italy. Mussolini was just starting in Italy. And they were from Europe, many Americans and many Britishers who married American men were there, and I taught them how to speak, how to give these reports. And then I found Madame d'Estaire, who taught all the men, 9 royal princes, and the men in the House of Commons, and their wives. All the Britishers take all their wives with them to speak on the same platform with them. I thought that was rather neat, at the time when our wives were kept under cover. And I used to stop them. My husband and I went all over London. I had a governess. I had a cook. I thought I had more important things to do there than to be glued to a little children that didn't need me as much as they did the governess, who knew how to take care of little children. And we went to that great series of British Shakespeare plays at that old theater down in the slums of London every Saturday night. They put on these great Shakespearean plays with no cups or anything, and very little furniture and very little clothes, but the great actors and actresses of England appeared. It's one thing they did. And then I lectured all over on England and America. I found that the British never study American history, so they're absolutely horrified in our country and what we do. And it's because they don't know. They only have 2 nations there. They have the Normans and the Anglo-Saxons and a few Welts and a few Scots, and that's all. And they didn't know how our country was made up of all these nations. So I lectured all over England on American history. And I went to the Fabian Summer Schools in the summer for my holiday. This German doctor said, also, I must have a holiday every summer, and not necessarily with my husband. I said, oh, I thought you always had to have a holiday with your husband. Why, he said. He needs a rest from you, and you need a rest from him. So I went to the Fabian Summer School and sat on the same table with Bernard Shaw 3 years running. And I've got one of his books in there dedicated to me, personally. We knew him very well. That was a great experience. And then later I followed him all over London. To hear Bernard Shaw speak was just like going to a great symphony. Oh, you never heard anything like it. Oh. Then I got Madame D'Estaire to come to the American Women's Club and teach all my women that were in the current events club how to speak. And oh, was that an experience. That's the first time I'd had any formal lessons myself, too. So there's a lot of stuff about what happened when she was teaching there. She taught 9 royal princes. She was from Ireland. And she wore a black robe, Roman toga, only it was black, and sandals, and she had a hair lip. She was without a doubt the ugliest woman I ever saw. And she worshipped the English language, just worshipped it. And could she teach speech? And she taught, she had a studio down there, and everybody came down to her studio once a week and spoke and practiced and got trained, men and women. So I found her, and I went to her classes. So I was quite busy.
And then you came back to the United States in about 19...
Well, then I was presented at court in 1928, and that's a whole story in itself, how I pulled that off. None of the American embassy had ever gone to court except the ambassador. I didn't see any reason why we shouldn't go. Our names were sent in every year to go. Why shouldn't we go? So they said, well, okay, but how are you going to afford it? And then this English woman got hold of me, and she said, Jesse, don't miss it. And I said, but we aren't rich, and I haven't diamonds to wear. And she said, none of the British have. We're all poor after this World War I. And she said, you put yourself in my hands, it won't cost much, and it cost $150 to go. The dress, the chauffeur, the limousine, the driver, pictures, everything came to $150. That dress you saw I had on there. She took me down to an actress's store where they sold dresses to actresses. And all the American women went to Paris for worth gowns at $2,000. My gown cost $40. And I got the woman that sold it to me to write me what it described it. And then when the press came along, I gave her, and I was the only one that hit the New York Times. To the anguish of the ambassador's wife and all the other ladies who had the top jobs and the worth gowns. My gown of $40. They didn't know it was $40, but anyway, that's all it was. Hit the New York Times. I never kept that picture, and that's stupid, wasn't it?
Mm.
Well, that's London for you. Then this Hughes boss, Mr. Dr. Klein, K-L-E-I-N, came over finally and said, you can't stay here any longer. You people, if you stay here any longer, you'll never want to go home. I said, we don't want to go home now. We love this place. And we had, oh, our home was so beautiful with all these oriental rugs. And then my husband had his organ. We took his organ over. He's a skilled organist, you see. And he'd had this organ since he was 6 years old, so we took that over. And our home was beautiful. And so he said we had to go home. And he made him head of the Department of Commerce in New England. And so we packed up all our antique furniture, and Uncle Sam brought it all back for us for nothing. And I came back with the cook and the governess as well. And then I began having adventures in New England because she could only stay 6 weeks. And the governess I had, oh, over there, she brought up 3 sets of children. Was she wonderful? But she hated me. She thought I was the damnedest mother she ever saw. And every night at the end of the day, I'd make her go into the dining room with me and tell me everything that happened and how she handled it. And I learned something about a mother, being a mother, you see. She was great.
Now that was,
she was a lot older than I.
1929 then when you came back?
So we came back 1929 to Needham, Massachusetts, just outside Boston, where we bought a 3-story, beautiful old New England house. Nobody at that time wanted big old houses like that, so we got it very cheap. Great big 3-story, beautiful old house right on Radford Street with the elm trees and everything. and put in our antique furniture. Oh, it was a beautiful home, just beautiful. And I rented the top floor to 4 school teachers. That paid the rent for the house. Why not have a nice home was my theory. And they loved it up there. I had all this beautiful furniture up there. And it was a very sweet place. And then I taught from 1930 to 1935. I taught 33 classes in public speaking all over New England. And I earned $2,000 a year lecturing on pomp and pageantry at the Court of St. James. All the women's clubs, they paid me from $50 to $150 for that lecture. And I had to take the court dress and put it on at the end of the lecture and come in and show them how to make the curtsy. It cost $150 to go, and I made $2,000 a year for 5 years for going. And I taught them a lot more things than court life. And women would come up, and then every year they had a big conference of young people on family life, and I gave them the talk on English court life. And the women would come and say, well, I thought if you were going to tell me I had anything to learn about family life from England, I was going to fix you. And I'd say, how do you feel now? And they'd say, I'm going home and make some changes. I really got that story tacked onto the court.
See? Did you maintain your position as a feminist in these talks?
I didn't advertise I was a feminist. The word wasn't classified as it is now. But I was a pretty good feminist. The $2,000, I saved most of it for the children's education. And as long as I didn't have to pay any rent on the house, I had a good income. My husband was a civil servant, but he got a very good income. Then he suddenly lost his job when the Depression came. Franklin Roosevelt fired all of the old people, and Hoover came in. Hoover was president during the Depression.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so all those, including Hugh, got fired.
Was that about 1932 when Roosevelt came in?
Franklin Roosevelt, when he came in.
It was 1932 then.
Yeah, it was 1932. When he came in, Hugh lost his job because Hoover had been his boss all in England and all that time. But he was a Democrat. But anyway, Franklin Roosevelt put in the father of his secretary in Hugh's job, utterly untrained man. And so he got a job. He thought, everybody said, now it's time he went into private industry. And he got a job at a big firm in Worcester that made wheels. What else was it they made?
But so you stayed in that same, in Needham?
Well, we wanted to stay in New England, but no, he got into this job. This man, my husband, had this magnetic personality, and he was not as good an administrator as he looked. And he was not that kind of an administrator that goes into private business. And he was given one of the top jobs in this big abrasives they made in that factory. And he was right up at the top over a lot of men that had been there for years. And he didn't know anything about that kind of politics that goes on. And within 6 months, they saw that he wasn't qualified for that kind of job. And the men under him saw to it, too. Meanwhile, we'd taken all that beautiful furniture over there and rented a lovely house, a beautiful house there. And then I added to the trouble. All these people, I loathe those factory towns like Worcester. And all those top people had a nasty little private school where they sent their children. And that your social status was how high was your husband's job in these factories. I loathed the whole thing. And they had no PTAs there. And they had a lot of Catholics and a lot of poor people, and very bad schools because the top people sent their children to this nasty little private school. So they didn't care whether the schools had any money or not. So I started a PTA, and that made him lose his job. You just didn't do things like that in a factory town where the social status was based on what your husband's did. It didn't completely cause his job to go, but it didn't help it any. I was not going to play that kind of game for anybody. Now, do you call that feminism?
Absolutely.
Huh? And I got the PTA started anyway. And then the man that employed him said, "Hugh, we just feel terrible." He said, we made a mistake. But we'll pay you. He was getting a big salary. What was it, $10,000 or $12,000? We'll pay you a half a year's salary when you leave, because we made the mistake. And then by that time, both of us began to want to stay in the room. This is an adorable place, you know. It's a sweet place. But nobody gets any good jobs in New England. He was a Harvard graduate, and he'd never set foot in a college. So he began pacing the streets to get another job there. And I saw he was going to have a breakdown. This is a terrible strain on a man, you know. If you read the Reader's Digest on why our men die in middle life, it goes into this. Did you see that article?
No.
Well, you ought to read it. 2 months ago. And so one day I said to him, now this is detailed, but I want you, this is terribly exciting. I said to him, come on now, we're going into London and blow up and have a big day blowout. He said, are you crazy? I'm out of a job. I said, you are getting that big salary for 6 months. Now we're going into Boston and have some fun. So we got in the car and went into Boston and we started walking up Beacon Street, Tremont Street. And there over on the window was a sign of an astrologer. And I said, come on, let's go up and see the astrologer. Well, he said, I know you're crazy now. Here I am without a job, we're going to go and see an astrologer, see? So we went upstairs. Now, you see, I have something that I know what is now, a kind of inner wisdom. And I've since found out what it is and where I got it and everything. But anyway, we went in and there was a reception room with nothing but some cheap chairs in it. And in the door, and I looked in, and there at the kitchen table sat a woman. Old kitchen table sort of thing, right on Tremont Street. And she wasn't busy, and I said, could we come in? And I went in, and she had the most beautiful face and eyes I ever saw. So I said, would she like an interview? And I asked how much it was, and she said it was $2. So we sat down, and she asked Hugh's date of birth and all that. And she started in, and she said, you are one of the few gifted men, gifted for public work, that I've ever seen. And that's your destiny. And Hugh said, maybe it was once, but it's gone now. And she said, it's coming back. There's nothing else for you but that. And there are too few that have that gift of doing public work. And she went on about this. Now, we just walked in there, you see. She had no way of knowing anything. And then she said, it's a funny thing, but she said, you know anything about ships? And he said, well, I've been across the Atlantic about 12 times, and he had to come home for business trips and all. Well, she said, I see ships all around you. I see them everywhere. And she said, meanwhile, she said, you're going back into public work.